Hello there and welcome into another edition of The Intersection with conversation about a variety of topics, including news, information, and lifestyles approached from a Christian worldview perspective. Well, October is a month that has been designated for honoring our pastors and church leaders, and Energize Ministries has been on the forefront in encouraging Christians to show appreciation for those who serve our churches. You'll be hearing from Andy Bowersox from that ministry. Then sharing a portion of her story of God's faithfulness even through difficulty, it's Sarah Rodriguez, whose husband passed away from strokes after a bout with cancer and who almost saw her infant daughter die as well. Plus, it's the lead actor of the forthcoming film I'm Not Ashamed in theaters October 21st. Macy McLean plays the role of Rachel Joy Scott, who lost her life in the Columbine tragedy. And on this edition of The Intersection, shifting to material related to politics or policy matters, you'll be hearing from John Bona, who offers a discussion of liberty based on a biblical worldview. Also, some comments from Tara Ross, a constitutional expert, who in a recent conversation offered some insight about the Electoral College, why it was set up in the way it was, and in her view, why it should be preserved as the method for electing presidents. You'll be hearing from her. Finally, it's Jim Dennison of the Dennison Forum on Truth and Culture, who has written a book identifying seven major issues confronting our culture. You'll be hearing some highlights of our recent discussion. This is The Intersection, a production of The Meeting House. I'm Bob Crittenden. Andy Bowersox is co-founder and executive director of Energize Ministries, which is involved with strengthening pastors, providing unique recreational opportunities designed to provide refreshing for them. October has been designated at Faith Radio as Pastor and Staff Appreciation Month, and Andy spoke with me recently about the importance of providing encouragement for our church leaders. Here now is Andy Bowersox.
I know that not everyone likes to reference statistics because they can be manipulated, but in the most conservative numbers out there from even a few years ago, that there's more than 1,500 pastors that leave their ministries every month due to some sort of burnout or demise. And while like anything else, that there's a lot of depth to it, I want to give you a story that helps illustrate what some of these pressures look like. I was speaking at a church one Sunday that I knew a lot about the staff that was there. And in the back row, there was right in front of me, there was a couple women that were texting back and forth about this girl that was on the stage, and she was part of the worship team. And this young girl didn't have any shoes on. And I was thinking, you know, they were upset about it. They thought it was disrespectful, and, you know, how hard would it be to keep shoes on their feet, and, you know, making these kind of comments. And I thought to myself, you know, if I didn't know any better, maybe I'd be thinking the same thing. But here's what these two ladies didn't know. That girl is the daughter of the worship pastor at that church. And that worship pastor has two other children that he can barely keep out of rehab. They're having all kinds of prodigal problems. And so the fact that the girl's not there at all really, to me, is something that should be celebrated. But we don't see that. We don't see what happens behind the curtain. We don't see what happens behind the stage. All we see is what's in front of us. And we're so apt to be critical and to be condemning of things that we don't know the whole story. And so that's really where our ministry is, you know, the passion behind it is, guys, you know, criticizing what you see to somebody else never is effective, right? Criticizing what you see to the person or who you think is the culprit, maybe that's helpful. But what if you could begin that whole thing with prayer? The prayer is the most effective thing. It may show you something. It may open your eyes to something you haven't seen. And it's the most effective thing we can do before we go jumping to conclusions. So I know that's a long story, Bob, but that's just one thing that's indicative of why our ministry is here, is to help people be more encouraging, to be more affirming, and reinvesting in the lives of their leaders, because they really need it. Listen, we're all about tangible and practical gifts, okay? What does that mean? Well, it may be something as simple as a gift card to a local coffee shop. It may be a text in the middle of the week or a thank you, maybe even a handwritten note or email that says, hey, Pastor, you know, you were talking out of Philippians this past Sunday, and here's how the points that you brought up about gratitude and thankfulness. I just wanted to share how it impacted my life this week. and what I was able to show the love of Christ to someone else. Pastors most of the time never get feedback like that. They get all kinds of other feedback, but it does wonders when you can send positive, encouraging feedback, and it ultimately increases the vibrancy and the health of your church and your congregation. So if your pastor's young, listen, what about sending them out for a weekend on the town or a night on the town and volunteer to watch their kids? There's things about, maybe massage or spa gift certificates that you can reach into the families and the spouses of some of these pastors. And you know, just think about the things you can do that practically, maybe mowing a lawn, it may be getting their car cleaned up, all of these things, any sort of gift of appreciation. In our ministry, just to kind of close this out, Bob, we're big on retreats, recreational, refreshing retreats. And we promote basically quarterly retreats for your staff and leadership. One of those may be one quarter, maybe an individual thing. Just give your pastor the freedom and the flexibility to go do something he enjoys. Encourage him to play, take a game of golf or go to the lake or fishing one day, whatever that thing is. But then next quarter, maybe it's an investment in their marriage and send them off on a honeymoon getaway or a weekend in the mountains or at the beach. And then the third quarter, maybe a family retreat. If your pastor has children, send their family out to an amusement park or to some sort of maybe a campground or hike or something of that nature. And then the fourth one would be if your church is large enough to have a staff, by all means, encourage them to take a staff retreat, even if it's a one-day thing, a team building, a unity building part. These things absolutely pay off in the expectation and the reflection of these events.
Andy Bowersox of Energize Ministries here on The Intersection. One way Energize Ministries is providing encouragement is through the Wall of Honor on its website at energizeministries.com. You have the opportunity to post words of appreciation, and at the end of the month, a pastor will be chosen to win a vacation retreat at the Energize Ministries Lodge in Virginia. Well, this is the Intersection Podcast. Continuing now, it's Sarah Rodriguez. She is the author of the book, From Depths We Rise, A Journey of Beauty from Ashes. In our conversation, she shared some elements of her story, including infertility, the loss of a husband, and a miraculous recovery of a child near death. She offered some spiritual perspective about God's faithfulness. From that conversation, this is Sarah Rodriguez.
She was born healthy, completely normal pregnancy, and actually everything began when she was 2 weeks old. One day she woke up and she was lethargic, and so I took her to her pediatrician, who transferred us to a hospital, who then stuck her in an ambulance and transferred to Children's Hospital. And by the end of that night, she was on a ventilator fighting for her life, and we were told that she had sepsis and bacterial meningitis. And as the weeks progressed, week after week, the situation continued to turn more dire. And finally, she stopped breathing along with the respirator, and we were given absolutely no hope for her to live. And we're told that if she did live, she would, you know, be in a vegetative state. And so we made a really difficult, gut-wrenching decision to remove her from her ventilator and say goodbye.
Mm. In fact, the doctors had told you that Ellis's brain scans were incompatible with life. You made that very difficult decision. By the way, as I understand it, it was a decision very similar to what you had made at the end of your husband's life about 17 months before that, correct?
Yes, and that's what made it all the more gut-wrenching. Mm. You know, here I was a year and a half later, I have this baby who is our beauty from ashes, and I thought all along there was such purpose for her life, and here I was a mere year and a half later, eerily having to remove somebody that I loved once again from a ventilator, and it was just beyond comprehension.
Well, Sarah, what happened next?
What happened next is the best part of the story. I told them that I wanted to have her removed from the ventilator, placed directly on my skin to skin, so she could leave the world how she entered it. And right before we did so, I ducked into a quick little bathroom to change into a hospital gown. And this was a defining moment in my life because I said, God, I don't know if you will, if you want to, but I know that you can, and I know that you have the power to save her life, and I'm asking you from the depths of my soul, please don't let this baby die. It's been 30 days. That's not long enough with her. So I came out of the bathroom, and they unhooked her and put her on my chest, and I read to her and cried and told her it was okay to go, and she would get to meet her father, and how jealous I was. And as the moments ticked on, she did not die. She lived. She stopped seizing. She started breathing on her own after she hadn't in weeks. And she defied all the odds and lived. And now she's going to celebrate her second birthday in a couple weeks. And she is growing and thriving. And she is, her life is miraculous.
That is so awesome. Talk about, as you had these experiences, how you saw the Lord really walk through these experiences with you.
You know, it was interesting because I lived a life, you know, I grew up in a Christian home, had, you know, went to private school. You know, I'd never really encountered any opposition in life. My life had just always kind of gone according to my plan. And that's how I had, you know, just expected it to continue. So when infertility started, that was the first like shakeup where I was like, okay, God, why is this not happening? And I don't understand. And then as we went deeper into it and cancer started happening, that's where it just felt like, you know, where are you and what is happening and why is this happening to us? But the really interesting thing about suffering is that it puts us on a fast track to be able to see and know and experience God in ways that few get to. And we called those the best worst days of our lives because here we were walking through the fire, but he was so near and he was so close and he was providing for our every need. And, you know, I say all the time, the verse in Job where he says, my ears had heard, but now my eyes have seen. And in those moments, he became so much more than just words on a paper, and scripture came alive, you know, where he would say that he won't leave us, he won't forsake us. Those weren't words. Those were truths that we were clinging to desperately like a life raft. And we saw him come through in those moments, and we saw his goodness, and we saw his faithfulness.
Sarah Rodriguez here on The Intersection. Learn more through the website journeyofsarah.com. The Intersection continues now with Macy McLean. She is the lead actor of the forthcoming film I'm Not Ashamed, which debuts in theaters on October 21st. In the film, she plays the role of Rachel Joy Scott, who lost her life in the Columbine tragedy. Here now is Macy McLean.
I think Rachel is known today a lot as just a really kind and compassionate person. And even if you've heard about Rachel's Challenge, which is an incredible program of just about kindness and compassion. But I think what a lot of people don't know is that kind of lifestyle that she lived and the way that she treated other people and the way she loved other people, it was all an overflow, really, of her time alone with the Lord and of her pouring out her heart to him, really, that you see in her journals. And that just that intimacy that she had with the Lord, and so the lifestyle that she lived was really a result of that. And so getting to read her journals and just see like the heart of what she was feeling and what she was praying throughout her life and what she was struggling with too. It was so neat to see that and then to see how she lived that out, I guess, and how she treated other people. But even reading her journals, something I didn't know was just her struggles. I didn't know the temptations that she faced or even what she was wrestling with all the time and what was going on in her heart, and a lot of people didn't know it, but she faced a lot of temptations and at times gave into those, and she wasn't this perfect, you know, like martyr for Christ. Like I know now she's known as kind of a martyr because, you know, when given the opportunity to deny Christ, she didn't, even if it meant her life, but she was not perfect in the least, and her journal showed that, like she was a real person, just trying to figure it all out and trying to figure out what it looks like to follow Jesus. And that's definitely shown throughout her journals.
If you would, Macy, set up the movie for us. Would this be considered to be more of a biographical picture centered on Rachel? is there, as far as the day at Columbine, how is that treated? Talk about some of the content of the overall film.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to be surprised when they go see it. When you see this movie, you'll definitely feel like you're watching a movie. You won't feel like you're watching a documentary or a reenactment, honestly, at all. It's definitely very story-driven, and just like a movie you would go watch in a theater. But the cool part about it is everything you see on the screen is taken out of her journals. It's just made into this movie and woven into this story, but it's accurate and it's true. So I think that part will surprise a lot of people, of just walking away feeling like they've seen a movie and not a documentary. And also the shooting, I think a misconception as well is that the movie's about the shooting or that day or what happened. And while that's definitely shown in the movie, it's not glorified in the least, or it's not played up, or, you know, it's not the focal point. Definitely the focus of the film is her journey and everything that's written in her journals up until that point. And really just like what was going on in her heart and what the Lord was teaching her and showing her and what she was walking through leading up to when she died at 17.
And as I understand it, even though it depicts the Columbine tragedy, what the filmmakers are really trying to do with this film is to leave filmmakers with hope. Talk about how that is being done.
Yes, and that's been so cool at the screenings that we've done so far. Everyone leaves feeling inspired, and it's such a hopeful movie. While at the same time there's tragedy, there is so much hope in it and so much joy in it. And I think the film shows that really by the legacy that she left behind and the lives that she touched and the lives that she made a difference in, that they're forever changed now because of the way she let the Lord use her in their lives. And so I think just the legacy of how much you can make an impact, like one life can make an impact in the world and such a difference, inspires people. And there's such hope in that, like the courage that it takes and the boldness that it takes, even to love people the way she did and to stand up for people the way she did and follow Jesus the way she did. It really takes just one person surrendering their life to that and truly living it out. And that's so inspiring, and that's kind of what people leave feeling.
Macy McLean here on The Intersection. You can find out more about the movie by going to imnotashamedfilm.com. Well, this is The Intersection podcast with highlights from the Meeting House program heard on Faith Radio and faithradio.org. You can learn more by going to the website meetinghouseonline.info. When you visit, you'll find a link to the download center marked Meeting House On Demand, through which you can listen to, download, or share full conversations with recent guests featured on the Intersection podcast. Also, through that website, you can subscribe to the Intersection and have it delivered to your podcast receiving software, including iTunes, on a weekly basis. Two blogs are accessible. Plus, you can follow me on Twitter and access the Meeting House Facebook page. You can also get connected to video content. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Well, John Bona visited with me recently. He is co-author of The Liberty Book, How Freedom Can and Will Be Won. In our conversation, he discussed the concept of liberty from a biblical perspective. He described liberty in the history of America and offered some comments on threats to liberty. Here now from that conversation is John Bona.
Well, basically, what we see, our nation's liberty is rare. But as we know, we're losing it now. We're losing our freedoms. Look at the people are being stopped from praying in public, honoring God in the public square. On the business side of it, you have regulations that are going out of the roof. Anybody in business knows this. And unfortunately, somebody made the phrase that Little Caesars is an acceptable name for a pizza business, but it shouldn't describe our civil authorities. And I thought that was clever. And so the connection, obviously, is that those civil liberties that we were guaranteed, our personal freedoms of freedom of conscience, press, religion, our own property, the freedom to assemble, to speech, even the right to privacy, self-defense, right? The Second Amendment. So our nation has long persisted on a path away from, unfortunately, from obedience and faith in God toward faith in enslavement by humans and governments. And that's very unfortunate. We've drifted away from that founding idea. And I think, unfortunately, it's like every promise for increased protection or some convenience that we think we'll get from the government, come more government officers to oppress us with books of rules to regulate our every move. Now, I'm not speaking about individuals that work in the government. You and I both know there's a lot of good people out there. And I know they listen to your station. But look, we license every trade and regulate every business, crushing the hopes. I have friends that their hopes have been crushed by this. And it's simply because we no longer have the Christian faith or the courage to live free. And that's what we need. The idea, I think it goes back to the root of taxes always. You know, the question is asked, how can a civil government be supported if only a small head tax, the only tax that the Bible talks about, could be lawfully collected? Well, the answer is how society is supposed to be constructed. And we talk about that in the Liberty Book. You know, I think probably the best way to explain the Liberty Book and this vision of our founders are the endorsements themselves. You know, our book, we were blessed to be endorsed by Kirk Cameron. He said, John and Don have a true passion for the story of liberty and won't stop until the whole world hears how to win it, defend it, and maintain it. Jim Kelly, NFL Hall of Fame quarterback, said, those playing football with our freedoms will never slow down unless we, the people, begin to understand the principles expounded in the Bible and the Liberty Book. Pat Boone said, more than once lately, I've delivered a speech called Losing Liberty, alarmed at the many ways our liberty has been compromised in recent years. And then Elvita King, you know, the evangelist, the niece of Martin Luther King Jr., said, the Liberty Book imparts a vital understanding regarding God's path to true liberty. And it goes on and on. Tony Perkins and Twyla Paris, Matt Staver all endorsed the book because they see how important our liberty and freedom truly is.
John Bona here on The Intersection. The website address is thestoryoflibertypress.com. Well, The Intersection continues now with constitutional expert and retired attorney Tara Ross. She discussed with me some aspects of the Electoral College, a topic she covers in the children's book, We Elect a President, The Story of Our Electoral College, as well as Enlightened Democracy, The Case for the Electoral College. Here now is Tara Ross.
Maybe the way I would say it is that the founders knew when they were creating their constitution that they were creating a constitution for an imperfect people, because all people are imperfect, and they knew that power corrupts. They knew that, you know, people would try hard and make mistakes, or they would get to the seat of government and they'd be there too long, and it would, you know, we would say drinking the Kool-Aid for too long. Now they would speak of it differently, but they knew this dynamic. And so I think there was a real misperception about the Electoral College that it was created because we lacked the, you know, good communications, or we didn't have the internet yet, we didn't have 24-hour news, and now that we have these things, the Electoral College is no longer needed. I really think that is a misreading of history. The founders did not create the Electoral College because we didn't have good communications or because it took long to get from place A to place B. They created the Electoral College just like they created every other check and balance in our Constitution, because they knew and understood that an imperfect people needed that. And only by putting checks on power would you be able to control that power when it was in the hands of a government official that could be corrupted.
Well, give us a little bit more insight into the nuts and bolts here of the Electoral College, how it operates, and I'm curious, has it changed a whole lot since the foundation of the nation?
It's changed a little bit. I'll start with how it works. When you go to the polls on Election Day, it looks like you are casting a ballot for a presidential candidate. You actually aren't. You are casting a ballot for a slate of electors who has promised to vote for a particular candidate. So I'm from Texas. We have 38 electors. There is literally one slate of 38 Republicans. There is one slate of 38 Democrats. there's a slate for each of the third-party candidates. These are different people. We're not expecting a Clinton supporter to go vote for Trump or anything like that. We are voting for a group of people who have said that they want to do what we're asking them to do. So you go vote for these electors, and the whichever candidate wins the state will get their slate of electors appointed to represent the state. Now, the real presidential election, the election that actually decides the identity of our president, is a separate election that occurs in December. And that is when the 538 electors who were elected on Election Day all go. They usually go to their state capital, but they go to one central place in the state, and they cast the ballots for the president of the United States. It takes a majority of those electors, so that's 270, to win the presidential election. If nobody gets a majority, then the election goes to another election in the House of Representatives. And in that election, each state has one vote. You asked how it's changed over the years. The basics of the system are the same. The things that have one big change, probably the biggest change that was made, was initially when electors cast their ballots, they would just cast two, and then the first place winner would be president, and the second place winner would be vice president. So you couldn't distinguish between your votes for which person should be in which place. So that changed. There was a tie in 1800. It was actually kind of an ugly situation. Thomas Jefferson was tied with the person that everybody knew should be the vice president, Aaron Burr. And so it went to the House, and it took 36 votes in the House before they could finally agree to elect Thomas Jefferson. And so we ended up with the 12th Amendment as a result of that process. And so now, of course, you go and the electors literally vote for one person for president and a completely separate person for vice president.
Tara Ross here on The Intersection. Her website is TaraRoss.com. Finally, on this edition of the Intersection podcast, it's the founder and CEO of the Dennison Forum on Faith and Culture, Jim Dennison. He's the author of a book called Seven Critical Issues, The State of Our Nation. He explored aspects of those issues from a biblical perspective. Here now some material from that conversation. This is Jim Dennison.
Abortion is the great tragedy of our day. Every year, more babies are aborted in this country than the total war dead in all of America's wars combined. But there's a reason for that. There's a reason that Roe v. Wade legalized abortion in 1973 after the sexual liberation movement of the 1960s and no-fault divorce. There's a larger narrative at work in our culture that says truth is what I say it is. You have no right to force your beliefs on me, and that relates specifically to my sexuality and to my body. And so we live in a day that says that the mother's right to choose is a cardinal kind of sort of tolerance that the culture must extend. And if we don't do that, then we're not pro-life, we're anti-choice, and we're anti-women, and we're anti-family in all these ways that make us look immoral. So at the end of the day, what that chapter wants to do is help us understand not only the issue itself, but why the culture thinks the way it does. Why has the culture shifted its view on abortion to a position now that it believes that life is negotiable and that it's up to the individual to decide what to do with their body? That's obviously an unbiblical construct. God is the author of life and the author of life eternal. And our bodies are given by him and our children are given by him. But our culture has completely changed its worldview at that point. And that chapter intends to explain how that happened.
Dr. Dennison, I'm looking at a list right here of the seven critical issues that you cover in this book. We were just talking a few minutes ago about abortion. I want to seize on something that you said as you were laying that out for us, and that is the view of sexuality that we see within our culture. You have those that have a view of sexuality that is quite different than that is prescribed in the Bible. And when you look at these seven critical issues, I would dare say that five out of the seven are related to a perversion or a corruption of God's view of sexuality. Elaborate on that just a bit, if you follow what I'm saying here.
Absolutely. Thank you for pointing that out. These really are symptomatic of the larger issue that's happening in the culture today. As you and I both know, there was a movement really after World War II towards secularizing this culture. The idea being that the church is outdated and irrelevant, that we've moved in this kind of naturalistic sort of secular way to believing that the Bible's outdated and irrelevant. Truth is what I say it is. You have no right to force your beliefs on me. Today, only 35% of Americans believe that there's such a thing as absolute truth, and 92% of Americans say they are their own sole determiner of moral truth. And so the larger kind of foundation at work here is this idea, the truth is whatever I say it is. Well, that gets applied in a variety of ways. That gets applied to how you want to define marriage. That applies to how you want to identify your gender. Has to do with same-sex relationships. It even has to do with how many relationships you're wishing to have. There's an organized movement in the country right now toward polygamy. There's even a movement called zoophilia that's trying to legitimize sexual relations between people and animals. There was a documentary that won a lot of awards last year called Dolphin Lover that's describing a sexual relationship between a man and a dolphin. Hard to believe, but that's absolutely the case. And all of that is symptomatic of this shift that says truth is what I say it is, so the Bible is irrelevant and I can do with my body whatever I want. That gets expressed in other ways, but primarily in sexual ethics. And that's why so much of the book addresses those subjects.
Well, and let's talk about something that we find ourselves addressing quite often these days, and that is the whole area of homosexuality. What is your approach to that topic, which actually leads into some other topic areas as well? But how do you frame that here in this book?
Yeah, thank you. I try to make 3 points. The first is that the Bible makes it very clear that homosexual activity is unbiblical, that it's outside God's will, it's outside of God's intended purpose for us. It's not what God wants for our lives. Second, homosexual activity is not the unpardonable sin. God loves gay people just as he loves straight people. Straight sin, whether that's premarital sex, extramarital sex, adultery, is sin just as homosexual sex is sin. That's important for us to understand. And third, we're to speak the truth in love. We're to demonstrate to gay people that God loves them even though they're living in a lifestyle that's outside his will. I'm broken as well. We're all broken sexually. Gay people are not more broken than straight people. They're sinning in places I'm not, just as I might be sinning in places that they're not. We don't want to communicate this message of hate that says to gay people that they cannot come to God, that they cannot receive the grace that can transform their lives. And so we don't want to endorse, of course, that which the Bible condemns, but at the same time, we don't want to condemn people that Jesus died for. So there's this balance that says that homosexual activity is unbiblical, but it's not unpardonable, and God loves all of us, whatever our sin.
Jim Dennison here on The Intersection. Learn more at Dennison Forum. That's D-E-N-I-S-O-N. DennisonForum.org. Well, we are nearing the end of this edition of the Intersection Podcast, a weekly production of The Meeting House. Learn more by going to meetinghouseonline.info. Through that site, you'll find a link to the download center marked Meeting House On Demand. Also, through that site, you can subscribe to the Intersection Podcast. Two blogs are accessible. One is The Three, featuring three stories of relevance to the Christian community. The other is The Front Room, with devotional thoughts and commentary from the Meeting House program. You can also access the Meeting House Facebook page and follow me on Twitter. Video content is accessible also. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Thanks for joining me for this edition of the Intersection Podcast. I'm Bob Crittenden.